Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we have an action-packed show for you today. Well, this is it, folks. The showdown for the Formula One Championship is going on right now. I'm up recording my show bright and early, as I always do on Formula One mornings. And so we're going to talk about, hopefully by the end of the show, I'll let you know who the new Formula One World Champion. Is it going to be Lando Norris, who has been leading the championship for a long time? Could it be Max Verstappen, who is chasing his fifth Formula One championship? Or could it be Oscar Piastri, the other driver who is for McLaren, who has led the championship for a good chunk of the year? We'll also talk about what's going on with NASCAR, with the trial. Michael Jordan actually testified on Friday. Got a great story about what's going on with a very cool Dodge 880 from the 60s. We'll also catch you up on what's going on with the new fuel economy regulations as the President Trump administration makes some drastic changes. Of course, it wouldn't be The Car Show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a very fast ride on The Car Show. This weekend, Formula One was in Qatar, and the headline reads, Verstappen takes title fight to the final round with Qatar Grand Prix victory. Well, Max Verstappen won the Qatar Grand Prix and slashed his championship deficit to just 12 points after a strategic miscue from McLaren left Oscar Piastri in second and title leader Lando Norris in fourth. Yes, as we were watching that race, I was just shocked that there was a crash early in the race. All the other teams came in and McLaren decided to stay out. And that's absolutely what cost them the chance to win the championship last weekend. So Max Verstappen won the race last weekend in Formula One at Qatar. Oscar Piastri in second. Carlos Sainz finished in third for Williams. That's his second podium finish of the year. Lando Norris in fourth. And Kimi Antonelli rounding out the top five. Now we head to Abu Dhabi. And the headline reads, Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, Verstappen takes a stunning pole ahead of Norris and Piastri. Well, Max Verstappen will start on the pole for the 2025 title decider in Abu Dhabi after beating his two championship rivals, Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri, to the fastest qualifying time. Max Verstappen is 12 points behind Norris in the standings heading into Sunday's finale, meaning Norris can secure the title on Sunday with a podium finish. Then it doesn't matter, regardless of where his rivals finish. So if Lando Norris can finish first, second, or third, it doesn't matter what happens with the other two championship drivers. Verstappen's best shot at a fifth consecutive title is to win the race and hope events conspire against Lando Norris to drop him to fourth or worse off. Piastri is 16 points off Norris in the standing, and his chances of making victory are slim unless something happens to the cars ahead of him on the grid. So the race is going on right now, and Max Verstappen is leading the race, and I'll have those results for you at the end of the show. Pages of Old Car Weekly. This is called End of a Dodge Custom 880. Well, the phone call a parent of any age dreads and hopes they never get came at 10:30 p.m. on a Saturday night, July 5th. A call at 10:30 on a Saturday night can never be good, unless you're expecting a new grandbaby. Well, my son Damon was on the other end of the line. Gratefully, he led off with, "I'm okay," which was a sudden relief, followed by, "But the car is totaled." Knowing he was at the hospital but had been checked out and released with only a bump on his head, my mind turned to the car. Now, we had found this 1963 Dodge Custom 880 two-door hardtop in Boulder, Colorado, and flat-towed it back to Nebraska in 1988. It was Damon's first car. He had been driving it and working on it for 37 years, even taking it along with him as he moved across the country. Now, the 1963 Dodge was a beautiful car, but few people are familiar with its heritage. Prior to the 1960 release, Dodges rode on 122-inch wheelbase, same as the Chrysler Windsor and the Newport and all the DeSotos, which exited the company in 1961. During 1960 and 61 model years, the higher-level Dodge Polaris and the Matadors continued on that platform, while 90% of the production was the new Dodge Dart line, the Seneca, the Pioneer, and the Phoenix, with 118-inch wheelbase. Now, as far as many of the customers were concerned, neither the size nor the styling of the 62s were very appealing. Loyal Dodge owners were flooded local dealerships saying, "Where is my big Dodge I'm used to driving?" Chrysler Corporation designers and engineers quickly responded. The full-size Polara was gone after selling a mere 14,000 passenger cars and station wagons during the model year of 1961. Chrysler assembly lines were still turning out the C-body Newports and 300s on the same 122-inch platform, so those unit bodies and cowls were combined with the front clips from the Polara to create a new Dodge Custom 880 line that hit the dealer showrooms in January of 1962. Some 17,000 four-door sedans, hardtops, two-door hardtops, and convertibles, six- and nine-passenger station wagons were sold by the end of 1962. A chromed die-cast grille with thin vertical bars, a new front bumper, taillights were all designed to give the 63 Custom 880 a fresh appearance. Production increased to more than 28,000 units. Another facelift in 64 included a redesign of the rear end and the grille, and production reached 32,000 cars, and then Dodge's big cars came to market for 65 with a totally new design, 3 series, 121-inch wheelbase, and the Custom 880 fell between the Polara and the Monaco. From 35,000 vehicles to 135,000 vehicles as sales progressed. So we towed Damon's 1963 880 home after his purchase. Even though it was running and driving, we didn't want to risk the possibility of something going wrong with a 25-year-old vehicle on a 500-mile road trip. Besides, the side windows had been broken out by vandals, which is why we got such a good price on it. Having replaced them was the first order of business to make it roadworthy. Now, Damon, well, he replaced the original 361 cubic inch V8 engine with a rebuilt 383 from a Plymouth Roadrunner, which had been provided trouble-free service for him. The interior had been upgraded during the process, as well as bucket seats and a full-length console from a 1962 Chrysler 300. Through the years, many upgrades and rebuilds had been taking place. Now, the Dodge had never been ready for prime time with show paint and upholstery, but it was fine for cruiser nights and an occasional road trip. Now, in his role as the editor of Good Guys Gazette for the Good Guys Rod and Custom Association, Damon had driven the Dodge to Des Moines, Iowa for the organization's Heartland Nationals. On that fateful Saturday night, he had worked late at the Iowa State Fairgrounds and was heading back to his hotel on the opposite end of the city. While driving about 60 miles an hour in the middle of the three lanes of the interstate highway, he was suddenly hit from behind by a large pickup truck. He thinks it might have been an F-150. The blow turned the Dodge 90 degrees to the left and crashed into a concrete barrier on the median side of the roadway. Damon now managed to get out of the car and was leaning against the barrier, taking inventory of his body parts, when a second pickup truck crashed into the Dodge's left rear quarter panel as it was sticking out into the driving lane. Truck number one had stopped on the other side of the road, but when truck number two got involved, well, the first one took off. I guess let somebody else take the blame for the crash. Damon had good coverage from Collector Car Insurance Company, which provided a settlement that allowed the option to regain and retain possession of the Dodge. The mangled remains of the once beautiful custom hardtop were hauled home, and many usable parts were salvaged, including an engine, transmission, and the 300H interior components. Well, two takeaways from this experience. Always wear your seatbelt. Damon's car only had lap belts, and he's always buckled in. The force of the crash into the concrete barrier bent his body forward, and his head hit the steering wheel. Also, Chrysler deserves credit for adopting the unit body design. Only 3 years before his car was built, the entire passenger compartment remained intact, while the front and rear quarters were completely mangled. None of the glass was even broken, except for minor cracking on the right part of the windshield, which popped out about an inch out of its frame from all the force. Now, finding a decent 60-year-old custom 880 hardtop as the basis for a rebuild is not an easy task. We discovered the Dodge division only built 2,800 cars of this model. However, Damon has managed to locate three and chosen to buy one to recreate his dream car. Having it done this once, maybe this time it won't take 37 years to complete. From Racer Magazine, read, Jordan takes stand in NASCAR antitrust case. Well, Michael Jordan, a lifelong NASCAR fan and a majority owner in 2311 Racing, explained in federal court Friday that he's suing the sport he loves because the economics are not being handled fairly. 2311 Racing and Front Row Motorsports were the only two teams of the 15 that did not sign the charter agreement that began in 2025. The joint antitrust lawsuit was filed in North Carolina federal court early in October of 2024. Quote, someone had to step forward, Jordan said, of taking such an action. I wasn't afraid. Now, Jordan was pitched by Denny Hamlin to start the team that is being known as 2311 Racing. Those off-the-cuff conversations were intriguing enough for Jordan to review the pitch deck that Hamlin sent him about getting involved. The team was formed in 2020 and debuted in 2021. However, Curtis Polk, Jordan's financial advisor and partner in 2311 Racing, did tell Jordan that he felt the venture was risky to your brand and image. Jordan smiled on the witness stand when counsel for NASCAR assessed that Polk admitted he didn't enjoy NASCAR as much as Jordan did, and he wasn't as big a fan. As Jordan said, obviously not. Jordan has estimated he's invested roughly $35 to $40 million into the race team, which he does not have a day-to-day role, considering himself more a fan. Jordan leaves those details to Polk and Hamlin. Now, Jordan, who pitched in $28 million to buy the third charter and expand to three cars for the team, Hamlin pitched in another opportunity to win races, pitched it as another opportunity to win races and improve their chances for a cup championship. Well, U.S. District Judge Kenneth Bell previously ruled that NASCAR is a monopoly, and the teams are looking to show that NASCAR has used its power in an anti-competitive manner, and the business model is hurting the race teams. And Jordan explained that once he and his partners entered the sport and signed the previous charter agreement, they really got an understanding about the business and the economic model. Quote, I'm not discrediting what NASCAR has done for the sport, Jordan said. He just wants to push to improve the sport. Speaking on the witness stand, Jordan believes there needs to be some growth and unity across NASCAR with its drivers. He also explained that working with stick and ball sports and with business partnerships between the league and its participants, in doing that, he believes that the ups and downs and growth finances should be shared responsibly and together. One thing I'm hoping for is to create more of a partnership between the two entities, Jordan said. If that's the case, it becomes more of a valuable business, and you can't compromise on things that matter. Then you can grow your business. And there are multiple reasons why 2311 didn't sign the charter agreement, according to Jordan. It wasn't just economical. Counsel offered advice on the clause about not suing NASCAR, and ultimately didn't sign was best for 2311. Now, Jordan testified for 25 minutes and giving NASCAR a chance to do its cross-examinations as well. At one moment, Polk told Jordan, our plan is to be a pest, have DB a mosquito bite to them every week, meaning to continue conversations with teams and drivers. Maybe things will end up in the media. So, also along the same lines, on that same day, Heather Gibbs, who is the co-owner of Gibbs Racing, testified for about an hour, which led into the lunch break, giving her background about how she got into racing by meeting and marrying Coy Gibbs in the 90s. Heather spoke publicly about the first time about Coy's passing, which was back in 2022. It was the same night that their son, Ty Gibbs, won the Xfinity Championship race on November 5th, 1922. Heather said he just didn't wake up. Well, Gibbs describes the sport as very challenging for teams because of the financial model. Joe Gibbs does not have outside income like other teams. NASCAR racing is their business. A comment by NASCAR's Commissioner Steve Phelps about the reckless spending race teams do prompted Gibbs to write a letter that sent to multiple executives in the France family. Gibbs said the comment bothered her and she disagreed with it. The lengthy letter became public a few weeks before the trial, consisting of Gibbs explaining about how much NASCAR means to the Gibbs family and a need for a stronger sport, including permanent charters. Lisa France Kennedy was the only one of the family who responded to Gibbs' letter. Gibbs felt it was a nice conversation. France seemed receptive, and Gibbs thought her letter had been impactful, but none of the other executives responded to her conversation. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this lawsuit. Right now, it's exposing some pretty dark underbelly of what's going on with NASCAR. So the trial will continue, and I'll let you know what happens and more information next week. Pages of our sister group, NPR, the Trump administration rolls back fuel economy standards. Well, the Trump administration started a process of dramatically easing fuel economy requirements for new vehicles as a part of the administration's broader pivot away from cleaner cars. At the White House on Wednesday, surrounded by executives from several major car companies, President Trump said the move would save consumers money by making cars cheaper. Quote, "We're officially terminating Joe Biden's ridiculously burdensome, horrible, actually, CAFE standards that impose expensive restrictions," Trump said, referring to the federal corporate average fuel economy rules, often called CAFE standards. All sorts of problems for the automaker, he said. Now, previous research from Consumer Reports has challenged the argument that regulations make cars more expensive. Stringent fuel economy standards also carry an economic benefit in the form of lower fuel costs over time. Now, the CAFE standards require that the entire fleet of vehicles sold by any given automaker, on average, get more fuel efficient over time. Automakers who fall short have previously needed to either pay hefty fines or buy credits from a company that overperforms on efficiency, like Tesla and other all-electric automobile manufacturers. Now, the Trump administration has already defanged the existing CAFE standards by eliminating the fines associated with them as a part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Under former President Joe Biden, the rules called for the vehicles to get 2% more efficient every year. The Trump administration has now proposed to revert to the 2022 baseline and increase by 0.5% annually. Now, the proposed change now enters a period of public comment with the Department of Transportation. They will collect input from companies and citizens before finalizing the rule. The administration has already been working to roll back tailpipe standards and set Environmental Protection Agency, which designed to cut pollution from vehicles. Two sets of rules have overlapping effects, both of them pushing automakers toward cleaner vehicles. Meanwhile, during the Trump presidency, Congress has also eliminated the Consumer Tax Act for purchasing electric vehicles and decided to end the tax credit for installing electric vehicle chargers in June 2026, earlier than planned, and voted to strike down federal waivers to allow California automakers to build zero-emission vehicles. The Trump administration also temporarily delayed a program to use federal money to build high-speed charging EV network. The policy shift is no surprise. Trump campaigned against what he called the electric vehicle mandate and promised to rescind the policies, including fuel economy standards and the encouragement or incentivized to buy EVs. Trump has framed the policy rollback as a gift to the automobile industry, which is partly true. Large trucks and SUVs may be inefficient, but they're popular and profitable, and selling more of them without penalty is a financial boon to the automakers. In earnings this fall, multiple executives noted the regulation rollback will boost earnings and help offset the costs of the tariffs that were created by President Trump. Electric vehicle adoption in the U.S. has moved slower than automakers expected. Some automakers have said that some of the Biden-era policies not just challenged, but also made it unworkable. In a statement by the White House, CEO of Ford praised President Trump's leadership in aligning fuel economy standards with market realities. But automakers are also navigating the global market, with many countries continuing to prioritize climate action and the popularity of high-quality, affordable Chinese EVs has raised the question of whether legacy automakers can compete. For companies, well, they need to plan their future vehicle lineups in years. But this whipsaw back and forth with each change of administration has been very challenging for years. Obama administration set ambitious fuel economy regulations. Trump 1.0 reversed them. Biden reinstated. Now Trump 2.0 is looking to reset. Farley also noted that the risk in conversation with investors in October, he explained why Ford is continuing to move forward with plans for an affordable electric pickup truck. Despite regulations shifting to no longer support EVs, we expect adoption will increase over time and the market will continue to evolve, and we know that regulations will continue to evolve as well. Buddy Chen Martinez always sends me interesting articles to look at, and he found one. This is from a company called Wion News, and it said, the headline reads, "Why hundreds of Porsches were mysteriously immobilized across Russia." Well, Porsche owners across Russia have reported that their fancy sports cars have become undrivable or bricked. Drivers in Moscow and other cities reported engine shutdowns, fuel delivery blocks. Rolf, Russia's largest dealership group, has reported service request spikes, according to the Moscow Times. The outage affects all potential Porsche vehicles and engines. Any vehicle could potentially lock itself, and it seems this might have been done on purpose. Well, here's what's going on, at least according to what these guys say, that they're thinking that the organization, the company, has actually shut this down on purpose. Everything seems to be fine with these cars, wiring, batteries, modules. Then I got into the VTS alarm unit and disconnected it and reconnected it without the satellite plugs, and all of a sudden, my car started. A friend had this same situation. Maybe it's interference. Maybe radio waves got it compromised. We don't know. And this is from a Porsche mechanic in Russia. Executives have failed to determine what exactly caused the outage. But right now, many people are disconnecting certain components within the Porsche so that it will the cars will work again. So this is could be a situation with the German automaker stopped supplying Russia since they full-scale invasion of Ukraine. They are not completely admitting that this is what's going on. So Russia, well, having a little issues with their Porsches. Official at 7:31 Arizona time, Lando Norris is the world champion in Formula One. He driving for McLaren, he finishes in first. Max Verstappen, who won the race, finishes second, and Oscar Piastri finishes in third. The race itself, Verstappen won, Piastri second, Norris third. But in the championship, final race, championship, Lando Norris driving for McLaren wins the championship, and McLaren is also the constructor champion, as their two cars were the best of the year. So congratulations to McLaren. You are the champion team of Formula One 2025. And from the pages of Old Car Weekly, this section called The Scoop, the post office plans on offering lowrider stamps in 2026. The United States Post Office plans to release an automotive lowrider-themed postage stamp next year. Lowriders, it's the slow and low, UPS said, outfitted with smaller tires and free wheels than factory, fancy paint jobs, and a special hydraulic system. These customized cars trace their roots back to the 1940s, working class American and Mexican Chicano communities of Southwest United States. Five models grace the stamps, a 46 Chevrolet Fleet line named Let the Good Times Roll, a 1958 Chevrolet Impala named the Figure Eights, eight figures, a red 63 Impala named El Rey, and an orange 64 Impala named Golden Rose, and finally a green 1987 Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme named Pocket Change. So look for those cool stamps coming out next year. Well, time to talk gas prices with our friends over at AAA. Well, folks, it's official. The average gas price in the United States is less than $3. $2.95 a gallon is the national average. Well, here in Arizona, our gas prices are down, but certainly not that low. Average gas price in Arizona is $3.24. New Mexico, $2.76. Colorado, $2.49. Utah, $2.94. Nevada, $3.62. California, $4.47. If you head over to Oklahoma, the average gas price in Oklahoma, folks, $2.32. Holy mackerel. Let's see what's going on with the rest of our gas prices here in Arizona. Well, the cheap gas in the state is down in Tucson. Walmart at $2.45, Costco at $2.47, Quick Trip at $2.47 as well. Well, a little closer to the metro, Marana is at $2.55, Eloy at $2.58 at the Love's Travel Stop, and the Pilot Station in Eloy at $2.58. Well, local gas prices here in Metro Phoenix. How about this, folks? Cash price, $2.85 at the Marathon station in Apache Junction, the Quick Trip station in Apache Junction, $2.89, the Sam's Club on 83rd and West McDowell at $2.98, the Sinclair station on West Indian School Road at $2.99, and the Top Fuel location on North Central Avenue at $2.99 as well. So cheaper gas has finally come to the valley. Well, it's time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, is it okay to keep your windshield wipers pulled away from your windshield on a snowy night? I heard it could stretch the springs in the arms, and that's from Mark. It's fine, Mark. This trick, for those of us who live in the great frozen north, use when it's going to snow or the snow is going to freeze. We pull up our windshield wipers away from the windshield so they're sticking straight up in what is called the service position. Now, that's normally used for cleaning the windshield or replacing the windshield wiper blades, but it also makes it easier for you to clean your windshield after snow or ice. I've lost a number of very good pair of windshield wiper blades when they accidentally get stuck to the windshield, or you accidentally hit them by cleaning the windshield. Now, sure, the springs get a little bit of extra use by extending the wipers, but you're not stretching them beyond their limits. But those springs can get weaker. And at some point, if they stop exerting enough pressure on the windshield, you start getting some chatter or some incomplete windshield clearance, especially at high speeds when wind is a factor. That would be the time to replace them. And they're only going to be a couple $100 unless you're stretching the arms out every night of the winter, which in that case, you should probably get a better weather app. The effect of this life of the springs is pretty negligible. Now, if you're worried about it, I'll give you another option. Put a small wood block or something like that under the blades to lift them off the windshield, just enough to keep them off an iced window. It's not as much to stretch the springs. Another option is to get a windshield cover. Basically, it's a blanket that goes outside your windshield and normally secures to your car with magnets or straps. That allow you to just remove the cover after a snowstorm or ice with it. They cost $20 to $30. You need to measure your windshield before you order one. And keep in mind it's made of polyester, so it's going to be soaking wet after it's used. You need to find a place to dry it. And if that's too much trouble, the benefits of standing your windshield wipers still outweigh the downsides. In my opinion, you should feel free to continue this age-old practice. Plus, hey, you know, the guys who make the springs, they got to eat too. Good luck, Mark. Yeah, here in Metro Phoenix, we usually don't have to worry about that situation with the amount of snow we get down here. And certainly I remember growing up in the Midwest in Indiana, people did that. Also, there are all sorts of little fun practices to make sure that your windshield wipers don't get stuck to your windshield on those cold, snowy nights. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for the car show today. My name is Jeff Wine. We'll meet you back again next Sunday. And you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.